This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. Lecture 1, given in Dornach, April 15, 1923. Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, at the opening of this conference, I want to extend my warmest greetings to you all. Had you come some 4 or 5 months earlier, I would have welcomed you in the building we called the Goetheanum, and which stood over there. The artistic forms of its architecture and its interior design would have been a constant reminder of what was to go out into the world from this Goetheanum. However, the misfortune that befell us on New Year's night, and that inflicted such grievous pain on all who loved this building, has robbed us of the Goetheanum. And so, for the time being, we shall have to nurture the spirit that was to have reigned within this material, artistic sheath without its proper earthly home. It gives me great joy to welcome those of you who have come from Switzerland, and who, by your coming, have shown real evidence of your interest in our educational aims, despite the enmity with which they have been received recently on Swiss soil. With equal joy and gratification, I want to welcome the many friends of Waldorf Education, or those wishing to become its friends, who have come from Czechoslovakia. Your presence confirms to me that education belongs to one of the most crucial questions of our time, and that it will receive the impetus it needs and deserves only if it is seen in this light by the various members of the teaching profession. Furthermore, I welcome those of you who have come from other countries, and who by your presence show that what is being striven for here in Dornach is not only a matter of cosmopolitan interest, but also a matter of concern for humanity as a whole. And finally, I want to greet our friends, the teachers of the Waldorf School. Their foremost aim in coming here is to contribute to this conference out of their own personal experience. Deeply connected as they are with our impetus, it was their express wish to support this conference. This is greatly appreciated. Today, by way of introduction, I want to prepare the ground for what will occupy us during the next 2 days. Education is very much in the news today, and many people connected with the education of the young are discussing the need for reform. Many different views are expressed, often with considerable enthusiasm, about how education should undergo a change, a renewal. And yet, when hearing the various ideas upon the subject, one cannot help feeling a certain trepidation, because it is difficult to see how such different views could ever lead to some kind of unity and common purpose, especially since each point of view claims to be the only valid one. But there is another reason for concern. New ideas for education are not unduly worrisome in themselves, for the necessities of life usually round off sharp edges, bringing about their own compensations. It is yet another problem that comes to mind when one hears the call for a renewal of education from nearly every person one meets. It is the following question: from where does this praiseworthy enthusiasm for better education spring? Is it not prompted by people's recollections of their unhappy childhood days, of their own deep-seated memory of an unsatisfactory education? But as long as the call for educational reform comes only from these or similar feelings, it merely serves to emphasize personal discontent with one's own schooling. Even if certain educational reformers would not admit this to themselves or to others, by the very nuance of their words, they imply dissatisfaction with their own education. And how many people today share this dissatisfaction? It is little wonder if the call for a change in education grows stronger every day. This educational dilemma, however, raises two questions, neither of which is comforting. First, if one's education was bad, and if, as a child, one was exposed to its many harmful effects, how is one to know the proper educational reform? Where can better ways of educating the young be found? A second question arises from listening to what certain people have to say about their own education. And here I want to give you a practical example, because rather than putting forth theories during this conference, I want to approach our theme in practical terms. A few days ago, a book appeared on the market that in itself did not draw any particular interest. Nevertheless, it is interesting because in the first few chapters, the author, an outstanding personality who meanwhile has become world famous, speaks a great deal about his early school days. I am referring to the memoirs of Rabindranath Tagore, which have just been published. Although I do not have the same interest in this person many other Europeans do, concerning educational matters, his memoirs do contain some noteworthy and pertinent details. I am sure that you would agree that the most beautiful memories of one's early school days, however wonderful these may have been, will hardly consist of fragmented details of what happened in certain lessons. Indeed, it would be sad if this were so. For what works upon children during lessons should become transmuted into habits and skills for life. In later life, we should not be plagued by the details of what we once learned at school, for these must flow together into the great stream of life. Aren't our most beautiful recollections of school memories concerned with different teachers we have had? It is a blessing if in later years one is able to look back with deep inner satisfaction upon having been taught by one or another admired teacher. Such an education is of value for the whole of one's life. It is important that teachers call forth such feelings in their pupils. This, too, belongs to the art of education. If we look at some of the passages in Tagore's memoirs from this point of view, we find that he does not talk about his teachers with much reverence and admiration. To quote an example, he says, quote, "One of our teachers in the elementary school also gave us private lessons at home. His body was emaciated, his face desiccated, and his voice sharp. He looked like a veritable Cain." Close quote. One might easily imagine, especially here in our Western civilization, that is so often strongly criticized in the East, that the wrongs of education would hardly be so vehemently emphasized by an Asian. But here you have an example of how an Eastern personality, now world famous, looks back at his school days in India. And so I shall use a word which Tagore also mentions in his book, namely, quote-unquote, school misery. The meaning of this expression is not confined to European countries, but seems to express a worldwide cultural problem. Later on, we shall have to say much more about what teachers must do in order to kindle genuine interest for what they bring to their pupils. But now I shall give you another example from Tagore's memoirs of how his English teacher set about this task. Tagore writes, quote, "When I think back on his lessons, I cannot really say that Aghore Babu was a hard taskmaster. He did not rule us with the cane." Close quote. To us, such a remark would point to times long past, long superseded. The fact that in his book Tagore speaks so much about the cane is indicative of what we would consider to be a primitive culture. I believe that one is justified in making such a comment when reading Tagore's description not only of one of his teachers as, quote, "looking like a veritable cane," close quote, but also when he points out that another teacher actually did not make use of the cane. Speaking of the latter, Tagore continues, quote, "Even when reprimanding us, he did not shout at us. But whatever his positive sides may have been, his lessons were given in the evening, and his subject was English. I am sure that even an angel would have appeared to a Bengali boy like a true messenger of Jamas, the god of death, had he come to him in the evening after the school misery of the day, kindling a comfortless dim lamp in order to teach him English." Close quote. Well, here you have an example our famous Indian speaks about his education, but Tagore also writes about how each child brings certain needs to his or her education. He points out, in a really practical way, how such needs should be met and how. In his case, this did not happen. I will leave it to you to translate this situation into Western terms. To me, it seems quite a good thing to look at such matters from a global perspective, matters which, if quoted in a European context, might well arouse strong criticism. Tagore continues, quote, "From time to time, Aghore Babu tried to introduce a refreshing scientific breeze into the dry routine of the classroom. One day he pulled out of his pocket a little parcel wrapped in paper, saying, 'Today I want to show you one of the Creator's wonderful works of art.' Unwrapping the paper, he brought to light a human larynx, which he used to explain to us the wonders of its mechanism. I still remember the shock this gave me, for I had always been under the impression that speech issued from the entire human being. I did not have the slightest inkling that the activity of speaking could thus be isolated from the whole human organism. However perfect the mechanism of each single part might be, surely it would always amount to less than the totality of the human being. Not that I realized this in full consciousness, but it was at the bottom of my feelings of distaste. The fact that the teacher had lost sight of such a truth must have been the reason why his pupil was unable to share in his enthusiasm for this kind of demonstration." Close quote. Well, this was the first shock when the nature of the human being was introduced to the boy. But another one, worse still, was to follow. Tagore continues, quote, "On another occasion, he took us into the dissecting room of the local medical school." Parenthesis, there can be no doubt that Aghore Babu wanted to give his boys a special treat. Close parenthesis. Continue, quote, "The corpse of an old woman was lying on a table. This in itself did not particularly disturb me, but an amputated leg, which was lying on the floor, completely threw me off my balance. The sight of a human being in such a state of fragmentation seemed so dreadful, so utterly lacking in sense to me, that I was incapable of shaking off the impression of this dark and expressionless leg for many days to come." Close quote. This example illustrates the reaction of a young person introduced to anatomy. Fundamentally speaking, this procedure is adopted in education only because it is in line with the orthodox scientific approach. And since the teacher himself has undergone a scientific training, he naturally thinks it is a wonderful idea to demonstrate the mechanics of human speech with a model of the larynx, or to explain anatomic physiological properties with the aid of an amputated leg. For contemporary scientific thinking does not consider it necessary to look upon the human being as a whole. However, these are not yet the main reasons for selecting certain passages from Tagore's memoirs. Of these, more later on, not because of their connection with Tagore, but because they belong to our conference theme. But first of all, I wish to make another point. Anyone judging Tagore's literary merits will rightly recognize in him an outstanding personality. And now, in the autobiography of this distinguished author, we read about his dreadful education. Does this not encourage a strange thought? Namely, that his poor education did not seem to harm his further development. Could one not conclude that a thoroughly bad education need not necessarily inflict permanent or serious harm? For did Tagore not demonstrate that, in spite of it, he was able to grow into a good, even a famous individuality? And examples of this kind could be multiplied by the hundred, even if in less spectacular form. Considering the myriad impulses for educational reform, one could easily be pulled in two directions. On the one hand, how can anyone possibly be in a position to improve education if he or she has had the misfortune of suffering from a bad one? On the other hand, if someone's school misery has not prevented him or her from becoming not just a good, but even a great and famous personality, a bad education cannot do permanent harm. Is there any point at all in lavishing so much care on attempting to improve education? From a superficial point of view, one might conclude that it would be more advantageous to occupy oneself with matters more useful than educational reform. If anthroposophy, which has been much maligned, were merely to offer yet more ideas for educational reform in the way this is generally done, I would not even consider it worthwhile to try these out in practice. But in reality, anthroposophy is something quite different from what most people imagine it to be. For it springs from the deepest needs of our present culture. It does not proceed, as so many of its enemies do, by denigrating in a most shameful way everything that does not agree with its own principles. Anthroposophy is more than ready to recognize and acknowledge what is good, whatever it is, wherever it is to be found. More of this later, for as I have already said, today's content is to be only an introduction. Anthroposophy calls our attention to the importance of the scientific achievements of the last 3 to 4 centuries, and above all to those of the 19th century, all of which it fully recognizes. At the same time, however, it also has the task of observing what effects these great scientific successes have upon the human soul. It would be foolish to believe that the thoughts of the comparatively few scientifically trained experts were of little consequence for society as a whole, for even people who know little or nothing about science are influenced in their mood of soul and in their orientation to life by contemporary science. Even people of a strictly orthodox religious faith, born out of tradition and habit, nevertheless, owe their orientation to the world to the results of orthodox science. A modern person's attitude increasingly takes its coloring from the scientific outlook, with all its tremendous achievements, which cannot be praised highly enough. Yet, the constitution of the human soul has been strangely affected by modern science. Having revealed more and more of outer nature, it has at the same time alienated the human being from himself. For what happens when the human being is observed from a scientific point of view? First, our attention is drawn to what has already been discovered in a most comprehensive way in the inert, the lifeless world. Then the human being is analyzed according to his physiological and chemical components, and what was established in the laboratories is then applied to the living human being. Or else our attention is directed to other realms of nature, to the plant and animal kingdoms. Here scientists are fully aware of the fact that they have not been able to establish laws equally convincing as those applying to inorganic nature. Nevertheless, at least with regard to the animal world, what has been discovered is then also related to the human being. This is the reason why in the eyes of, quote, the man in the street, close quote, the human being is the final step in the evolution of the animals. The evolutionary ladder of the animal species ends with the emergence of the human being. Up to a certain point, the animals are understood. Their bony structures or muscular configurations are then simply transferred to the human being, who consequently is considered to represent the most developed animal. No true picture of the human being has as yet arisen out of these methods. And this will become poignantly clear to us when we focus on education. One could say that while in earlier times human beings occupied a central position within the existing world order, they now stand displaced, crushed by the weight of geological data, and eliminated from their own sphere by the theory of the evolution of the animals. Merely to trace back one of the ossicles of the human middle ear to the square bone, Quadratbein, sorry, I don't know if that's a German word, I think, of a lower animal, is hailed as real progress. This is only one small example, but the way in which human physical nature is a reflection of the soul and spiritual nature seems to have been entirely disregarded by modern research. This kind of thing easily escapes notice because the orthodox approach is simply taken for granted. It is a byproduct of our modern culture, and quite rightly so. Indeed, it would have been a sad state of affairs if this change had not occurred, for with the attitude of soul which was prevalent before the age of science, humanity would not have been able to make proper progress. Yet today a new insight into the nature of the human being is called for, an insight based on a scientific mode of thinking, and one which will also throw light on the nature of the entire universe. I have often tried to show how the general scientific point of view, which in itself cannot be praised too highly, nevertheless can lead to great illusions, simply because of its innate claims of infallibility. If one is able to prove science wrong in any specific point, the whole thing is relatively simple. But a far more difficult situation arises when a scientific claim is correct within its own bounds. Let me give you an indication of what I mean. What was it that led to a theory such as that of Kant-Laplace? With the aid of this theory, which has been lately modified and which is known to practically every educated person, scientists tried to explain the origin of the Earth and of our planetary system. In their calculations, some of them went back over long periods of time. When one scientist spoke of some 20 million years, soon enough he was considered a greenhorn by others who spoke in terms of 200 million years. Then other scientists began to calculate the length of time of certain processes which are taking place on Earth today. This is a perfectly correct thing to do, for from a strictly material point of view, there is nothing else one can do. Sedimentation or metamorphosis of rocks was observed, and from the data gained a picture. Sedimentation or metamorphosis of rocks was observed, and from the data gained, a picture was built up, explaining how certain changes came about, and the length of time involved was then calculated. For instance, if the waters of Niagara Falls have been falling on the rocks below for such and such a period of time, one can calculate the amount of erosion which has taken place on these rocks. If one now transfers this calculation to another spot somewhere else, where a considerable larger erosion has been found, by means of a simple multiplication, one can calculate the time this must have taken. Following this method, one may arrive at, let us say, 20 million years, which, as far as the calculation is concerned, is quite correct. In a similar way, one may start with the present time and, according to another well-known theory, calculate the time it will take for the Earth to become subject to heat death, and so on. Yet such a procedure might equally well be applied to quite a different situation. Observe, for instance, how the human heart changes from year to year. Noting the differences, one could investigate, following the same method applied in the case of Niagara Falls, how this heart must have looked some 300 years ago, and what it would look like some 300 years hence. Technically speaking, this method would be analogous to that of determining the times of geological changes, and in this sense it would be correct. Observing the heart of a person aged about 35, one would be basing one's calculations upon an organ that has been functioning for a considerable length of time. However, one obvious detail has been overlooked, namely the fact that this particular heart did not exist 300 years ago and that it will not be there 300 years from now either. Though mathematically speaking the calculation is correct, it bears no relation to reality. In our present intellectual age, we are too preoccupied with whether or not a thing is correct, whether or not it is logically right. But we have lost the habit of asking ourselves whether it conforms to actual and real life situations. We shall come up against this problem again and again during this week. But sometimes it can happen that when apparently correct theories are followed, even fundamental issues are simply overlooked. For instance, you may have witnessed, I am not implying that as teachers you have actually carried out this experiment yourselves, for present company is always excluded when negative assertions are being made. You may have witnessed how the rotation of the planets around the sun was graphically illustrated to even a class of young children. A piece of cardboard is cut into a disc, and its center is pierced with a pin. A drop of oil is then put onto its surface before the disc is floated on water. When the pin is twirled around to rotate the floating disc, little droplets of oil will shoot off at a tangent, making quote-unquote little planets, little oil planets. And in this way, a most convincing model of a planetary system has been fabricated. Needless to say, this experiment is supposed to prove the correctness of the Kant-Laplace theory. Well, as far as one's own morality is concerned, it is virtuous enough to be self-effacing. But in a scientific experiment of this sort, the first requirement surely is not to omit any essential detail, however small, and to include all existing criteria. And is the teacher spinning the disc not the most important factor involved? Therefore, this hypothesis would make sense only if it were taken for granted that long, long ago a gigantic schoolmaster once twirled round an immense world pin, thus setting, spinning our entire planetary system. Otherwise, one should not make use of such a hypothetical experiment. And so, many elements of an unrealistic soul attitude can be detected in the very cases where science appears to be in the right, where its findings cannot be contested, and consequently these elements of error easily creep into educational practice. How could it be otherwise, for those engaged in teaching are perforce a product of their time, and this is as it should be. And when they come across such geological calculations or astronomical analogies, everything seems to fit so nicely together. Sometimes one cannot help but feel amazed at the incredible ingenuity of scientific interpretations, which, despite their apparent power of conviction, nevertheless can lead us away from reality. However, as educators, we must never deviate from actual reality. In teaching, we are facing reality all the time, and this must spur us on to get to know human nature as it really is. In a certain sense, this failure to penetrate human nature has already crept into present-day educational thinking and practice. I should like to illustrate this point by an example. Whenever you are dealing with children in the classroom, you will find that some are more gifted in one or another subject than others. Most of you will be familiar with the current thoughts and methods regarding this problem. I am referring to them here only to create a basis for mutual understanding. So there are different degrees of abilities in children. And how are these dealt with, especially in today's most progressive centers for educational science? From your study of educational literature, you probably know about the so-called, quote, correlation coefficients, close quote, which have recently been introduced in schools. In accordance with this method, the correlation coefficient 1 is put down if a pupil shows an equal aptitude for two different subjects. Actually, such a thing never occurs, but hypothetically, it is simply assumed to be the case. If, on the other hand, a natural gift exists for two subjects which are mutually incompatible, the correlation coefficient 0 is given. The idea of this method is to test and measure the pupil's various gifts. For example, you may find that drawing and writing carry the correlation coefficient of, let us say, 0.7. This means that more than half the children who are gifted in drawing also have a natural skill for writing. One looks for correlation coefficients also in other combinations of talents. For instance, writing is linked to a pupil's ability to deal with the mother tongue, and in this case the correlation coefficient is put down as 0.54. Arithmetic and writing carry the correlation coefficient of 0.2. Arithmetic and drawing 0.19, and so on. From this it will be seen that arithmetic and drawing are the least compatible partners, whereas writing and drawing are matched most frequently. A natural gift for both the mother tongue and for drawing is found to be equally present in approximately 50% of the pupils. Please note that on principle, I do not object to this kind of scientific research. It would be wrong to declare that such things should not be investigated. As a matter of fact, I find these things extraordinarily interesting. I am not in the least against such experimental or statistical methods of psychology. But if their results are directly implemented in education, it is as if one were to ask someone to become a painter without mentioning to him or her the importance of having to deal with color. It is as if instead one were to say to such a person, quote, "Look, here is a good book on aesthetics. Read the chapter about painting, and that in itself will make you into a good painter." Close quote. A well-known painter in Munich once told me a story which I have quoted on several other occasions. While he was a student of the local art school, Carrera, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, it's spelled C-A-R-R-I-E-R-E, I'm going to pronounce that Carrera, the famous professor of aesthetics, was lecturing in Munich. One day the painter and some of his fellow students decided to go and see this famous expert who also lectured on painting. But one visit was enough for them because, as they put it, all he did was, quote, "to crow with aesthetic delight," close quote. This is how it strikes me. If people think that they can draw benefit for their educational practice from the kind of thing mentioned above. Interesting though these experiments may be from a scientific point of view, something quite different is needed for the practical classroom situation. What is needed there, for example, is that the teacher is able to penetrate human nature so deeply that she or he can recognize from which inner functions the skills for drawing and writing originate, or what it is that enables a student to use his mother tongue well. To achieve such a faculty, a living observation of the human being is required, which eventually may lead one to discover how specific capacities for, let us say, drawing or for the use of the mother tongue flow out of some children. Here, statistics are of little use. One must take one's cue from what the child reveals of itself. At most, such statistical evidence may serve as an interesting confirmation afterward. Statistics do have their value, but to believe that they can become tools for educational practice only goes to show how far one has become alienated from the real nature of the human being. Today, many people look upon statistics as a key for the understanding of man. In certain spheres of life, this does have its justification. It is possible to build up a statistical picture of the human being, but such a picture will not allow us to understand the human being in depth. Think, for instance, of how useful statistics are in their appropriate sphere, such as in insurance. If I want to take out a life insurance policy, I will be asked how old I am, and I must give evidence of the state of my health, and so on. From such data, the level of my premium can be worked out very neatly, depending on whether I happen to be a youngster or an old fogey. My life expectancy is then calculated, and these details exactly meet the needs of the insurance business. But what if in my 37th year I had taken out a life insurance policy for, let us say, 20 years? Would this make me feel obliged to die at the age of 57, simply because of what had been calculated on paper? To enter fully into the stream of life is something very different from following certain established criteria, however logically correct these may be and however beneficial they may be in their proper sphere. When considering the question of aptitude for writing and drawing in children who have just entered school, one must bear in mind that they have reached the stage of their second dentition. In the coming lectures, you will hear more about the children's different stages of development, and about how one has to divide their ages into three groups: the period from birth to the change of teeth, the period from the second dentition to puberty, and finally the time following puberty. Later on, we shall go into more details about what is happening in children during these three periods. For the moment, let us consider this question of writing and drawing. Science, having scrutinized so minutely the three kingdoms of nature surrounding us, now transfers the knowledge gained to the human being. Knowledge of the outer world and the mode of thinking about outer nature now becomes the key to the understanding of the human individual. And yet, if one observes the human being in his or her own sphere, one will come to recognize the true situation. One only needs the courage to do so with the same accuracy and objectivity with which outer nature has been studied. Present-day research shows this courage only when observing outer nature, but flinches from applying the same methods in the study of the human being. Let us look at how the child develops from birth to the change of teeth. As you know, this change of teeth is a unique event in life, inasmuch as it occurs only once in a lifetime. Now, if you are able to experience feelings similar to those Tagore expressed when he saw the amputated leg, you will realize that what reveals itself in the change of teeth is not confined to what is happening in the jaws alone, but that it must be something encompassing the entire human being. You will feel that there must be something pervading the whole child until about the age of 7, and that there must be some activity that reaches its climax in the change of teeth. It is there in its original form up to the 7th year, and after that time, it is no longer present in its original state. When studying physics, for example, scientists have the courage to speak of quote-unquote latent heat, apart from the various forms of liberated heat. According to this concept, there must be some form of heat that cannot be determined by means of the thermometer, but that can be measured once it has been released. When characterizing these phenomena occurring in nature, scientists have shown courage in their interpretations. However, when the human being himself becomes the object of study, this courage is no longer there. Otherwise, they would not hesitate to declare what has been at work in the child up to the 7th year to become liberated during the change of teeth must have been bound to the physical organism before becoming freed and reappearing in a different guise as inner soul properties of the child. Parenthesis, this same process can be recognized also in the other regions of the child's bone formation. Close parenthesis. One would realize that these newly emerging powers must be the same, though transmuted in form, as those which previously had been active in the child's physical organism. One only needs the courage to look at the human being with the same powers of cognition with which outer nature is studied. But this present-day science is not prepared to do. However, if we do this, our attention is drawn toward all that belongs to the bony system, to everything that hardens the human form to give it structure and support. Orthodox physiology might go this far. If not so today, then surely in due time. The most important branches of science are undergoing considerable changes just now, and the time will come when they will follow along the lines indicated. But something else must also be taken into account. In later years, the child will be introduced to many different subjects, such as geometry. Today, in our intellectual age, one has an abstract concept of three-dimensional space, to choose a very simple example. One imagines three lines at right angles to one another hovering about in space and extending to infinity. It is possible to form such a concept abstractly, but in that case it is not inwardly experienced. And yet, three-dimensional space wants to be experienced concretely. This does happen, though unconsciously, in a young child at the crawling stage. When losing its balance time and again, it will eventually learn to acquire the upright position and to achieve equilibrium in the world. Here we have a case of a concrete experience of three-dimensional space. Here it is not merely a question of drawing three lines into space, for one of the three dimensions is identical with the human upright position, which we can put to the test by no longer assuming it, by lying horizontally or sleeping. This upright position signals the most fundamental difference between the human being and the animal. For unlike the human backbone, the animal's spinal column runs parallel to the surface of the earth. The second dimension we experience unconsciously every time we stretch our arms out sideways. The third dimension is the one that moves from our front toward the back. In reality, the three dimensions are experienced concretely in above and below, right and left, forward and backward. What is done in geometry is but an abstraction. Human beings do experience with their bodies what is shown in geometrical constructions, but only during the age when they are still largely unconscious and dreamy. Later on, these experiences are lifted into consciousness, taking on abstract forms. Now, with the change of teeth, the forces that bring about an inner firmness, an inner consolidation and support have reached a certain climax. From the moment when the child is able to stand upright until the time when the inner hardening processes manifest in the change of teeth, the child inwardly, though unconsciously, tries out, quote-unquote, body geometry as an activity which is akin to the activity of drawing. With the change of teeth, this now becomes a soul activity. That is, it enters the realm of the child's soul. We may be able to understand this transformation better by means of an analogy. Just as in a chemical solution, upon cooling a sediment falls to the bottom, leaving the upper part all the clearer, so on the one hand there is the physiological aspect of the hardening process, the sediment, and on the other its counterpart, the clear solution, within the child's soul realm, that manifests itself as a faculty for geometrizing, for drawing, and so on. From this time on, we can see the child's soul qualities streaming outward. Just think how such a discovery engenders real interest in the human being. We shall observe this streaming out in greater detail, and also how, later on, it is reflected back again. In this respect, everything in life is linked together. What we do to the child has not only an immediate effect, but influences his whole life. Only a few people are prepared to observe a human life as a whole, but most of them focus their attention on present circumstances only. This is the case, for example, when one makes an experiment, when one is dealing with the present only. On the other hand, have you ever observed how the mere presence of some old people can be like a blessing in the company of others? They need not even say a word. Simply through what they have become, goodness radiates from their presence. And if you now look into the biography of such old persons, you may find that when they were children, they learned to feel reverence quite naturally, without any outer compulsion. I could say equally well that they learned how to pray, whereby I mean praying in its widest sense, which includes a deep respect and admiration for another human being. I should like to express this thought in the form of a picture. Whoever has not learned in childhood to fold hands in prayer cannot spread them in blessing in old age. The different phases of life are all interconnected, and it is of great importance in education to take this into full account. We learn a great deal about the child when we recognize how soul forces well forth after they have completed their task of working in the physical body up to the end of the first 7-year period. Psychologists have made the strangest hypotheses about the interplay of soul and body, whereas in fact one period of life throws light upon another. What we can see in the child, between the change of teeth and puberty, will tell us something about the soul forces that had previously been engaged in working within the child's physical realm. Facts speak for themselves, shedding light upon each other. Think of how such things will stimulate interest in education. And genuine interest in the human being is what is needed in education today. Far too many people think about the relationship of body and soul, or of soul and body, only in abstract terms. And because so little of real value has emerged, a rather amusing theory has been formulated, namely the theory of the so-called psycho-physical parallelism. According to this theory, processes of soul and body run side by side on a parallel course. No need to bother about points of intersection. No need to bother about the relationship between body and soul at all, for they are supposed to meet in infinity. This is why this theory sounds like a joke. However, if one allows oneself to be guided by practical experience, one will be able to discover the real interrelationship of body and soul. All that is needed is that one looks over a person's whole span of life. Let us take an example of someone who develops diabetes or rheumatism at a certain age. When trying to find a remedy for such an illness, usually only the present conditions are taken into account. This in itself is quite justified. It is certainly right to make every effort to heal a sickness whenever it occurs. But if one surveys the whole life of the patient, one may discover that many a diabetes is due to the fact that the memory was overtaxed or developed in the wrong way between the change of teeth and puberty. Health in older years is largely conditioned by the way a person's soul life was developed during childhood. The way a child's memory is trained will affect his or her metabolism after a certain period of time. For instance, if between 7 and 14, undigested vestiges of memory remain in the soul of a child, they will be precipitated, roughly between the age of 35 and 45, as physical residues that can then lead to rheumatism or diabetes. It is no understatement to intimate that teachers should have at least a modicum of medical knowledge at their disposal. It is not right for them to leave all matters concerning the child's health to the school doctor, who usually does not even know the children. If any profession in our times requires a wider background, then education needs it most of all. This is what I wish to tell you as an introduction to our conference theme, so that you can judge for yourselves when you hear some people say that anthroposophy now also dabbles in education, whereas others believe that it does have something valid to say on the subject. Those who are ready to listen will not be swayed by people who are of the opinion that there is no real need for education, or that there is no point in discussing it, simply because their own experiences in this field have been so frustrating. Anthroposophy takes its beginning from an altogether different attitude. It does not merely wish to correct old ideas, but it begins with a true picture and knowledge of the human being. For these, in accordance with humanity's progress, have become a necessity today. If you go back to the older forms of education, you will find that they have all arisen out of the general culture of their time, out of the universality of human feelings and experiences. We too must find a universal approach again, flowing out of human nature itself. If I had my way, I would give anthroposophy a new name every day to prevent people from hanging on to its literal meaning, from their translating it from the Greek, in order to form their judgments accordingly. It is immaterial what name is attached to what is being done here. The only thing that matters is that everything we do here is focused on life's realities, and that we never lose sight of them. We must never be tempted to implement sectarian ideas. And so, looking at education in general, we come across the opinion that there already exist plenty of well-thought-out educational systems, but that, since we are all suffering so much from the intellectualism of our times, it would be best if intellectuality were banished from education. This is quite right, but then the conclusion is drawn that instead of developing a science of education, we should appeal again to our inherent pedagogical instincts. However desirable this may sound, it is no longer possible today, because humanity has moved on to a further stage of development. The healthy instincts of past times are no longer with us today. A new and unbiased look at education has to be backed by fully conscious cognition, and this is possible only if our understanding can penetrate to the very nature of the human being. This is what anthroposophy is all about. One more point. Intellectualism and abstractions are so rampant today that there is a general feeling that children should be protected from an all-too-intellectual education, that their hearts and feelings should also be educated. This is entirely right. But when one looks into educational literature and current practice, one cannot help noticing that such good intentions are not likely to lead very far, because, once again, they are formulated in a theoretical and abstract manner. Still less is it made clear that this request should be made not only on behalf of the child, but that it should be addressed also to the teachers, and above all to the pedagogical principles themselves. To do so is my aim. We must not pay mere lip service when stating that we wish to educate the heart of the child and not only his intellect. But we should ask ourselves how we can best meet this challenge. What must we do so that education can have a heart again? The end of Lecture 1.